Blog Talk Radio.
From two beautifully scenic and historic locations, the Hudson Valley, New York, and Willow, Alaska, this is the Side Vibe, brought to you by Dog Works Radio. Your hosts are author, journalist, and photographer, the Five Sides mom, Dorothy Wills Raftery, and Dog Works Radio executive producer, canine behaviorist, trainer, and lead musher of Team Aneke, Robert Forto. The Side Vibe is all about the magnificent breed of the Siberian Husky. From training to grooming, and for those who show and breed, from parenting to playing and rescuing huskies in need, whether mushing over snow-covered trails or lounging on tropical shores, even for Hollywood sides on the big silver screen and so very much more. If it's about a Siberian Husky, we'll chat about it here.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska. And on the line is our host, Dorothy Wills Raftery. Dorothy, how's it going?
Hi, good morning, Robert. Good morning, everyone. It's going well. It's going well. We have it's going to be a pretty muggy day here today. So I think all the Husky kids are going to be lounging in the house today in the air condition. How's it by you?
It is warm, but it is a beautiful summer day. We're in the middle of the midnight sun. I don't think it's getting dark at all up in these parts, making it difficult to sleep, even though I've been here for 3 years. This is my third summer. It's still tough to go to sleep when you can go out and play in the yard at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Oh, it must be. And so, like, tonight is the supermoon. So I wonder, how is that up there? Are you able to view it even though it's daylight hours?
We are not able to see the moon hardly at all, and of course it's often overcast here in the evenings too, so we don't get a whole lot of moon viewing or stargazing in the summertime.
Ah, okay. Well, you'll have to check out my Facebook page. I'm going to post some of those supermoon pics tonight, and it'll be interesting to see how some of the dogs, because I know sometimes it affects some of the dogs. So I wanted to ask you a quick question before we start today's show. How maybe you can just talk to our listeners a little bit about your upcoming illustrated children's book, Team Aneke, A Musher's Dream. I know that's tentatively scheduled to be published later this year through Arctic House Publishing. You must be getting excited about that.
You know, we are so excited about that. My wife and I, Michelle, are working on that in conjunction with you and an illustrator that you're very familiar with. And, man, what an awesome little book. You know, it is a children's book. It's only 15 or 20 pages, but it really tells the story about our team, how we got started, and what brought us here to Alaska. And it's going to be a great little book. Like you said, towards the end of summer, beginning of fall is when we're going to release it. And I think people are just going to love the illustrations, don't you?
Oh, I do too. I think the illustrations are adorable. I think this is going to be a great educational tool. I know you want to hit the road and, you know, do some visits along with your one of your dogs, and I think this is going to be an excellent tool for children, and it's going to be a fan favorite with adults too. I can see it.
I think so, and you know, the illustrator really captures the true colors of some of our dogs, especially the highlights of the book, Bodie and Reagan, which are a couple of our Siberians. And I think it's going to be a pretty comical venture down Team Aneke's way as they take a look at what we're doing up here in Alaska.
I think that's going to be great. And I know I want to give a shout-out to the illustrator, Barbara Slocum, and she does. She's doing some great work, and that's what it's all about, capturing, you know, the emotions and capturing your personality of your dog. So it's exciting. It's an exciting project. I think people are going to love it.
I do, too. You know, today's show, I've been looking forward to for a few months now. It is the reason why we mush, at least most of us that jump behind a sled are doing it for one reason or another, but most of us are trying to replay history a little bit, and I think we're going to tell that story today with our guests. Is that right?
We are. Today, our guest is Academy Award nominee Daniel Anker of Anker Productions, or API Films. Daniel is a writer, director, and the producer of the documentary film we're going to be talking about called Icebound, which was filmed in your state, home state, Robert, of Alaska. This movie is about the 1925 Serum run to Nome, and according to the film's website, which is at www.iceboundfilm.com, it says, in January 1925, more than 30 men and at least 150 dogs battle storms and life-threatening cold weather in a daring relay of anti-tank toxin across the frozen wilderness to save the children of Nome, Alaska, from a deadly outbreak of diphtheria. The story of the serum run is legend, a heroic testament to the human spirit and to the indomitable achievements of the dogs of the far north. For the first time on film, the real story of the 1925 serum run, Alaska's great race against death, is being told. A little bit about Daniel. Daniel Anker's credits include Scottsboro, An American Tragedy, for which he received an Oscar nomination and an Emmy Award, Music from the Inside Out, a documentary featuring the Philadelphia Orchestra, which enjoyed a successful theatrical run and was the finalist for the International Documentary Association's Distinguished Feature Award, and the acclaimed film Imaginary Witness, Hollywood and the Holocaust, for the BBC and AMC, which has been shown widely around the world. He has several new projects in the works, of course, including Icebound. A veteran producer of national programming for PBS, Daniel's credits are many, including being the producer for 3 seasons of the PBS broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera. He also produced the Peabody Award-winning series Marsalis on Music. Daniel is a co-author of a curriculum based on his film Music from the Inside Out, published by Alfred Music Publishing. And it was used in school districts across the country. He has spoken widely at conferences and seminars on film and filmmaking, music education, the Holocaust, civil rights history, and other topics related to his work. He recently served as advisor for the Sundance Institute Film Composer Workshop in Utah. Awards and honors include a Peabody Award, 4 National Emmy Award nominations, the Eric Barnow Award from the Organization of American Historians, and multiple grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. Daniel, we'd like to give a big welcome to you to the Sci-Vibe today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Daniel, when did you first get interested in the historical story of the serum run, and why and how were you inspired to do the film Icebound?
All right. Well, you know, I, with rare exception, I'm not an expert on the topics that I choose to do films about. And mostly what I like to do is find something new and kind of immerse myself in a new world that I'm not connected to. I learned about this story for the most part. I mean, I live in New York. I know the Statue of Balto. I've vaguely heard of the story, although I'm much too old to have grown up with the Balto movies. But I have some old friends, Gay and Lainey Salisbury, who wrote a great book about the serum run called Cruelest Miles. And it's learning about their work, and they brought it to me, that I sort of immediately felt that this was an incredible topic for a documentary film. Not only the sort of inherent adventure story, but the idea that it's a very small story in a specific time and place, which makes for great historical films, because you sort of use the smallness of the story and then extrapolate out into the context under which it was made, and it just appealed to me greatly, and I felt that it was something that I felt that there was potentially a source of funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, which is a federally funded grant for filmmakers, and in fact, after several years of developing the project, we were able to get some funding from them.
Now, what makes this historical event, you think, so interesting, not just to tell, but for people to watch? I mean, I myself love historical items, and you know, but what do you think would be the general consensus of why this would be such an interesting story for people to hear?
Well, you know, one of the thing that I find most fascinating, and I hope has resonated with you after watching the film, is something that I came to understand when I was very far into the process of the film. I mean, I'd gotten this grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, which finally allowed me to make my first trip to Alaska, which I dedicated that first trip to, this was 2008, to finding any surviving witnesses, is the sort of generic name for it, but any interviewees, any people who could speak to the story from firsthand knowledge of either the people involved in it or the events themselves. And in tracking down those folks, which I did in both villages along the trail and in Nome, I suddenly came to the realization that the story is a legend, and like many legends, there are a lot of misunderstandings about it and a lot of misinformation in the telling of the story. And it very soon became a kind of, how should I put it, not a game for me, but the work became 10 times more exciting because it wasn't a historical truth that existed in the historical record in books. It was something, this sort of illusory truth that I wasn't sure what that truth was. How many men were there? Who were the dogs? How many dogs? Who was left out of the story? What is the nature of the epidemics in the region? What was the doctor doing? Were people really sick? How sick were they? What was the danger? And all of that is still remains kind of an unresolved truth. But the film sort of became a look at history itself and history's relationship to myth. And within that story and looking at those things, all these sort of historical tangents and contexts came into play. Most potently, the Alaskan Native role in the story, and the influence of the very real segregation and prejudice at that time, the public health issues, the epidemics that preceded the diphtheria epidemic. All of this was fascinating. And then on top of that, there's the role of the media, which really created this myth, and how it was created also became a story I wanted to follow. So I can't recall your question, but I hope
that's
I answered
okay.
it.
And, yes, yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I did preview the film, as did Robert. And Daniel, it is an excellent film. I'm very excited for when it does come out for people to see, you know, that you actually did talk to these people who actually lived through the Serum Run and their descendants who reflected back on this and as you said, back on their stories and watching how the media played a part. And, of course, being a photojournalist, I was very interested from this part. And going back to how, you know, it was just so interesting on how they took a bit of news and they weaved it into these, like you said, these tales that were passed down, and you're uncovering these layers. I just found it very fascinating. For me, the whole movie, the whole film was over, and I was still so engrossed. So I'm very excited about it coming out. And how did you find the folks? I know you went on the search, and that's what you did in your first trip to Alaska, but how did you find these people to speak with you on film, and how receptive were they to, you know, to being filmed and telling the tale from their perspective?
I think there was no resistance to talking, and in terms of finding people, it's in this kind of project, which I've done before, it's work that has to be done on the ground. It's not something you can make a phone call and find out. You sort of have to go from person to person, even visiting nursing homes and trying to locate the eldest members of a community and people who not only are of a certain age, which in this case was, you know, 85 or 90 and older. Several of the people were in their 90s, but they had to be people who had lived in that region their entire lives. It's really a matter of oral history and talking from one person to another person, and names come up that people don't think of the first time you ask them, and then they say, oh, you know who you should talk to, you know, and slowly find people who are still living who have these memories.
Which are so valuable. It's like you said, the oral history of it. I mean, now you're putting it down, so, you know, it's on film, and it's great for just being aware of some of these other things. And, you know, I just, what do you feel was their main recollection of the Serum Run, like when you first began talking to them? you know, it's interesting because in watching it, there was so many different layers to it that I was just curious as to what did you find one of the first things that they recall about it or that stood out in their mind from
it? Right. Well, you know, it's a big puzzle piece because no one has overall knowledge of this. And these people that I'm talking about were children at the time. And you have to kind of, as you're talking to them, separate out what hearsay is that they grew up with from what they might have seen and experienced themselves. But you know, in striving for authenticity, there were a number of people who clearly had this sort of firsthand experience with the story in one way or another. There was a woman whose father was the head of the mines in Nome at the time, and lived next to the kennel where Togo and Balto and the other dogs were kept, and whose father was taken by Sepala every morning by dog team to work. And, you know, so her recollections of the dogs themselves, which were her playmates as a child, and Sepala from a child's perspective, and how the fear of diphtheria, how the epidemic played out at that time and how it compared to other epidemics or health scares at the time, that was incredibly valuable, and her recollections of the doctor in particular. And another woman who was a native woman on the outskirts of town, but she had suffered greatly, her family had, in the flu epidemic, which plays a significant role in this story in a kind of tangential way, the 1918 flu. And her, just hearing from her about the just overwhelming amount of death from illness close to her family in one fell swoop was just a very powerful thing. And she too also had memories of the doctor, and there are other people who could talk about life in Nome at that time, which wasn't too far from the gold rush, and their memories of the miners and sort of life in this, this incredibly unique spot on the planet
right,
at that time. Yeah.
And watching it, I think too, you know, we hear the news stories, and being I'm removed from Alaska and I'm not involved in sled dogging, I want to pull Robert in a little while too because he is in that environment. I think what came across, and you don't think of it, is the fear and desperation that this doctor must have felt, because it is an isolated area. They couldn't easily get medication. This epidemic was evolving all around him, and that was just another layer you put in there that was just so interesting to hear, you know, what he had to go through and how he felt trying to deal with all this that was going on, as well as how are they going to get the medication in there by playing by dog. And, you know, that whole thing I thought was really very, very interesting. And you had several historians and writers that you interviewed that were, quote-unquote experts that were included in the film. How did you go about, deciding on these people to include them in? And, again, it just added to the film as well to hear, you know, them come in, you know, and give us this overview of what went on.
You know, that's actually an interesting question because, unlike other historical stories and events, there aren't scholars of this story at all. The one thing I didn't want to do is have sort of detract from that authenticity that I mentioned by having someone talk about the story in an inauthentic way or just repeat what's in the written record, which is by and large a regurgitation of myths and anecdotes that are either true or false, but they exist solely because of a tabloid media of the 1920s. So I was very careful in the other kinds of voices that populate the film. And there are not that many of these historians, but the few that there are people that had real expertise one way or another. There's a professor who surprisingly, lives in Tennessee, Preston Jones, who happened to have written a wonderful book on Nome and the history of Nome, and he was very valuable and had some insight into that. There's an anthropologist, Matt Ganley, who now is on the executive staff at the Bering States Native Corporation, but Matt had done some work that I came across on the 1918 flu, which was very singular in my experience in how he looked at how the media at the time looked at the you know, the local media in Nome paid more attention to deaths outside of Nome in the white population than they did the entire Nome native population that was dying right in front of their eyes. It was just a fascinating thing that he discovered, and he speaks about that in the film. Stephen Haycox, who is a premier historian in Alaska, really helped unravel at this higher level some of the politics that was going on at the time. It's Governor Bone, who was an appointee from Washington, and looked at with some trepidation by people within Alaska. He had a fairly large role in the story, both the rescue itself, in how it played out, and also how it played out in the press, because he was a former journalist and had close ties to the Eastern press. So each of these interviewees really had something very special to offer, and that's generally why they were chosen for the film.
Now, for readers who are just joining us, we are talking with Daniel Anker of Anker Productions, the producer and director of the film Icebound, about the 1925 Sierra run to Nome, Alaska. You can this film is also narrated by the actor Sir Patrick Stewart. You can read more about this film and see a trailer to the movie at www.iceboundfilm.com. And also, if you visit my blog at fivesides.blogspot.com and type in Icebound in the search box, it'll bring up my in-depth interview from March with Daniel and the movie trailer, plus some pretty cool production photos from the filming of the movie. Daniel, you actually retraced some of the routes ran during the Sierra run, is that right, with some pretty well-known mushers. Who did you travel with, and what was that experience like for you?
So that was a very exciting, I mean, there's several different adjectives I could use, you know, exciting, cold, scary, but overall valuable, I would say, experience. And I wanted authenticity for the film. You know, part of this grant, the kind of mandate of the grant that I received from the National Endowment for the Humanities is an expectation of authenticity that it's not just a film, but it's a sort of living document that probably won't be attempted again, and so it'll have, you know, if I could say in all modesty, it'll be in some senses definitive in its telling of the stories to a certain audience anyway. And so there is this responsibility to do it right. I just didn't want to film in Canada or, you know, Central Park, you know, at the first snowfall or whatever. So we sought out the original locations. We spent a great deal of time in Nenana, outside of Nenana, with Aaron Burmeister and Bill Cotter and their kennels. We shot all along the coast. I spent some time in Galena. There's another musher, Donald Warwick, in Unalakleet, who helped us out. You know, I should take a moment just to say that, and I guess our website mentions as many names as I possibly can, but it certainly takes a village to make a film. I mean, this is not the effort of one person. I had, for example, co-writer Susan Kim, But beyond that, just the number of people within the state of Alaska who participated and helped in all sorts of ways is just enormous and very gratifying. And so part of what they offered was this expertise in finding this authenticity, and you know, the sons of three of the mushers from the Yukon region that we interviewed did a lot more than just appear on camera. They really helped us figure out where things happened, and there were some sites mentioned in oral histories that were not on maps that we wanted to try to locate to verify the verisimilitude of some of the stuff we wanted to use. And Patty Nolner, who's the son of Edgar Nolner, sang a native song as part of the telling of his uncle's story, Joel George Nolner's story. So it's just being on location in the places where it happened just informed the film immensely.
And some of the shots that you have incorporated in there while weaving this historical tale, I mean, it really it gives a person who's not from Alaska or not familiar with how vast and cold and snow, I mean, you really portray those conditions, and it really comes across. I know that you said one of your interviewees, legendary musher George Atla, had said a quote that you found very profound. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it's you know, he's in the film. I got to know him at again due to the generosity of people in Alaska. I was invited to hang out at a mushing conference in Fairbanks, and George Atla was there, and I was able to get him to appear in the film. And his, you know, he did actually know these mushers, some of them, but his real expertise is just knowing the trail and knowing the dogs and knowing that era of mushing. There's a line he says in the film, which I'm going to probably misquote to you, but something along the lines of, you know, if you take a dog over a patch of trail, you know, and then 5 years later you take him over the same patch of trail, he'll never lose his way because a dog never forgets, something like that.
That's very profound. Now, Dan or Robert, you're a current musher with Team Inekē, and what do you think of that quote? I mean, you know, you work these trails and the dogs all the time.
I do, and I think that quote really stands out. I've taken dogs out on trails, you know, one year to the next, and they follow that exact same trail, whether one has cut a new trail with a snow machine or something early in the season, that dog will go back to that original trail. So I think that is definitely a true quote. And of course, George Atla, for folks that don't know who he is, at least in the mushing world, he's one of the top guys. He is definitely the general of the mushing world in terms of names. You know, Daniel, if I could step in just a minute. First off, I want to thank you for being on the Sci-Vibe, and second, I really enjoyed your preview of the film. It was a great documentary, and as I said at the beginning of the show, this is why a lot of us, at least in present day, this is why we mush, because of this event, and it's why the Iditarod is in effect. You know, it traces a lot of that same trail, even though it's a competition, much like what they were doing in the ceremony. It wasn't necessarily a competition, but it was more of a relay. But it is why a lot of us do what we do day in and day out and live this lifestyle up here in Alaska and other parts of the world. But also, I don't know if you came across it, at least in your research, but every other year they do an event called the Serum Run Expedition. And they take off on the original route in Nenana. In February, they pick up the quote-unquote serum from the train, and then they hopscotch along that same trail that they followed from Nenana to Nome, delivering this quote-unquote serum to the folks in Nome. And as they go down the trail, they stop in these villages and talk about a public health message, whether it be suicide or immunization or, you know, domestic violence, that sort of thing. So it is an event that follows this trail and tries to retrace history. It was an event that was brought on by Norman Vaughn, an explorer, and for folks that know anything about mushing, they know that name, Norman Vaughn. Did you find out anything about the Sierra Mount expedition in your research for this film?
Yeah, well, I talked to a number of people who participated in it. I think my visits never exactly coincided in any meaningful way with activities of the present day serum run, but I met with Carolyn Vaughn, who was incredibly helpful in providing some leads and information and knowledge about the history of the event and people to talk to, and Hannah Motorow, who has run the serum run several times and is a musher, was one of the my most reliable and informative colleagues in Alaska, and I do know a lot about that. I think the message of what they're doing is an incredible way to look at this event, other than just as a great story, and I applaud that tremendously. And our film, we intend to have a kind of outreach. An educational life, as most documentaries have, with some similar outreach events, and maybe even align with them if that could work out. But I haven't had a chance to pitch that to anyone there. But I think what they do is phenomenal, and public health is for me one of the great kind of overlooked messages historically in the film, and briefly, because I think that people tend to tell the story as a singular event, and of course epidemics were not singular at that time in that region. They were pervasive and devastating consistently, and so, you know, to make the serum run all about public health is a really admirable and valuable thing.
So Daniel, you also tell the story of the dogs, and I think that's an important component of this. This relay couldn't have been done without the tenacity of the dogs, and of course the mushers that are driving those guys. And of course you tell the story of two dogs in particular, probably the most famous sled dogs in the world, Togo and Balto. And one received a little bit more fame than the other, at least in most mushing circles. That story is very well known, but a lot of folks don't necessarily know that competing story in of itself between Togo and Balto. Can you share a little bit about that, in particular the part about Togo, how about him being kind of the outcast of the group, and then, of course, him, quote-unquote, saving the day?
Balto, right, you're talking about. Of course, the legend that many people do know, and in Alaska I think you would find more people, many people aware of the significance of Togo in the story,
right.
And a good deal of anger about his place in history, which really comes directly from Leonard Sepulveda and his anger and how that played out at the time. I mean, the story is briefly that Leonard Sepulveda was the champion world-class musher on the run that most of the other mushers were certainly not racing champions, although they were incredible mushers and heroic men. But from the perspective of the outside world, there was sort of a singular musher involved, Leonard Sepulveda, because he was the racing champion. And his lead dog, or one of his lead dogs, I should say, was Togo, who, by his telling of it, really helped him across the sound in a kind of desperate situation in a storm, and mushed many more miles than any other dog did. The final relay of the final leg of the relay was Gunnar Kassen's team, and Gunnar Kassen actually had borrowed dogs from Seppala's kennel in Nome to make the run, and picked a dog that Seppala had ignored in his races, Balto. Balto was the dog, or as some might say, the one of two dogs who led that team into Nome and became the star of the Zero Run. And in terms of fame, has you know, clearly overshadowed Togo over the last 100 years, 80 years, whatever.
And Togo was a senior dog as well, right? Because Togo was 12 years old.
Togo was 12 years old. There's also some debate about his age, but I've seen it written by Encephalus memoirs, an age that placed him at 12 years old at that time.
I actually felt very bad for Togo and Seppala. You know, when you watch it, I mean, of course you feel for them right away because, you know, it's this amazing dog and putting all these miles on and taking on this. And I guess basically if I can encapsulate it, he didn't, simply because he didn't do that last leg is why he didn't get the accolades.
Right. I mean, it's just the press was looking for, you know, he was the story. Leonard Seppala was the story for a few days there. I mean, this story played out in serial form. People followed it from day to day. And Seppala was at one point the story, and I think that story played out. And by the time, you know, the serum was arriving in Nome, the press was looking for something else. And they found it with a hero dog. And that was Balto. And Balto then had a life... he was courted by Hollywood. He and Gunnar Kassen went to Hollywood and they made a movie and they traveled around the United States. And, there's sort of a long postscript story of Balto that is triumphant and sad at the same time. Cut to 60 years later and he's the star of these animated movies, in a Spielberg movie, and certainly the children's books are where, it was interesting to hear you talk about your book that's coming out, a children's book, because a lot of the genre of mushing literature is children's books. And
right.
And Balto has had a presence in American culture, in part due to children's books about Balto.
True. When my daughter was young, we got her the Balto books and even a stuffed Balto. So, you know, for me learning about, and I've learned about Togo over the years, but hearing it in this film, it was just so much, you know, it's so interesting, and he played such a large role, and not to be as well known. Now, Robert, is the story of Togo more known up in Alaska than it is, say, here?
Well, you know, Togo's body, I guess you would call it, is in the Iditarod headquarters here in Wasilla, in the screening room where their films are. So he's still around. Folks really know the story of Togo and, of course, of Balto. But, you know, Dorothy, if we could just sidestep here just for a second, most Siberian Husky owners don't know that the majority of our history of the breed comes from Togo and Balto's history. You know, that's how the Siberian came to be here in America back in the 30s when the world was introduced to a lot of these dogs because of Seppala and his travels, Balto and his travels with the dogs in the lower 48 here.
Wow. Now the film mentions something about when they introduced the Siberians as well, because they were smaller. They used mixed breeds, Malamutes, is that correct? And then they brought in the Siberian Huskies?
Well, at that time, they were still using a lot of the village dogs, the dogs that were bred to do the jobs that they were doing. And often it was carrying mail and other supplies over the trail. And then, of course, Seppala brought in this kind of ragtag breed of dog that he had gotten from folks over in Russia, and then of course that became known as the Siberian Husky that we know today. Definitely different strains of have been developed over the years, but that's really the history of the Siberian Husky is from this group of dogs that was brought over from the Russian folks, which is, you know, not too far from here up here in Alaska. You know, Daniel, when you were visiting the folks up here and talking about this history, what I find interesting, as you mentioned, it's kind of an oral history, more along the lines of the way that the Native Americans tell their stories. But there, with that, there's also a lot of conjecture, a lot of filling in that part of the story that may or may not be 100% factual. Did you have to do a lot of record checking, a lot of fact checking when you were listening to these folks tell the story, and how did you go about doing that, since this is more of a oral history type story than it is written record, especially out on the trail itself, not necessarily the event, but the way that the mushers hopscotch down the trail?
Yeah, I mean, I have to, you put your finger on it. It is, and we did fact check, a tremendous amount of fact checking. I have 10,000 newspaper articles in our office that we amassed because we realized that's where we could actually trace the story from. And whatever records we could find, there are medical records from the doctor's office. There are lots of telegrams existing in the governor's records at the time. One of the interviewees, whose father, as I mentioned, was the head of the mines, he happened to have his own collection of documents and telegrams and so forth related to the story, but there were things where there were certain discrepancies, and the discrepancies that may not matter in the larger telling of the story, but the discrepancies that we wanted to try to figure out. You know, what date, who traveled from where to where, things about how many kids actually did die, how many actually were sick. You know, when stories started appearing in the paper, how they, all of that, we did our best to fact check, with I would say one exception that we just couldn't fact check and felt like we should let legend be legend, which is that each individual musher has his own story about what he faced, what weather condition. Some of that is fact checkable from the weather records, but in general we let the stories as they were told at the time go unchallenged, because there's no facts to challenge them with, and that's part of the what's great about the story anyway, is that it's a story of not one person's recollection, but it's, you know, even with that, without the people that I spoke to, it's by its very nature a story of many people's recollections that only exists because there are multiple people telling it, and multiple people can only tell what they know because they were alone on the trail.
You know what I find interesting, Daniel and Dorothy, is to most of these mushers, it was really a non-story. They were just doing what they do all the time, delivering goods, whether it be mail or other packages, on down the trail. It didn't really become a story until the way that the United States was operating at the time, with the advent of the airlines and the telegraph and everything coming together all at once to get out information to the masses. To the mushers, they were just doing their job, and I think to them, they just had to do what they had to do to get to that next checkpoint, and you know, that's what they were doing. Do you agree with that or disagree?
You're asking me or Dorothy? Sorry,
you, Daniel.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's mostly truth in what you say. It has become a kind of conventional wisdom that most of the mushers, they were just doing a job, and part of that has turned into somewhat of a it doesn't fully take into account who some of the native mushers were and what they faced, because, you know, yes, their jobs were taking the mail from point A to point B, but not going nonstop in the dead of night, no matter what the weather, because some child was dying and relied on their efforts. So I think that to each of them, very few of them thought it was business as usual, except with regard to the idea that life in the Arctic was hard and in that region was difficult, and it was not out of the ordinary for people who were sick or needed help, you know, for people to do so by means of dog team. I mean, that was the only way to help them. So emergency mushing, if that's a term I can use, was not out of the ordinary, but they weren't necessarily just doing the job that they normally do. It wasn't business as usual. But
right.
But I do agree with you in the larger point that you're making, that this was life for them, and this is what they did.
Right.
And even Sepala, you know, he had rescued other people who were trapped, or there were other stories of medicine being transported by dog team. I mean, that was not a singular thing with the serum run.
And you hit it right there on the head when you said that emergency mushing. That, I think that was the point I was trying to convey, but you said it so well there. It was just, you know, we've got to do this, we got to do this now. But to them, they weren't seeking the fame. You know, they were just doing what they did. They, you know, they got on the sled and they went on down the trail to deliver the serum. It wasn't like today where, you know, you do something and as soon as you do it, you post it on Facebook. Hey, I've conquered this task of whatever it is. To those folks, they were just doing what they did, and they did it the best. Dorothy, what do you think about how the story kind of played out in terms of the media? You know, I thought that was a very interesting part of this, about how it just exploded, you know, through the media, whether it be the Telegraph or the newspaper, et cetera. You know, back then, you know, the stories were told in the newspapers. You know, there wasn't any TV, very little in the way of radio and that sort of thing. What do you think about that, Dorothy?
Right. I think everyone loves a good story. And this, of course, is one of the great stories. And at the time, I think it was, you know, to get the word out. I found it interesting when, you know, they wrote them like serials, you know, serial stories. And again, you know, it's like they pass down the story and things get added or changed as it goes along. But I think the key is, you know, to share the story. And it's not a lot different than media today. It's just different means and
right.
longer taking of it. But I always think that key is to get that story out there. Sometimes it's embellished. Sometimes it's strays a little, but, you know, and of course it's like anything. If you one time they had an episode on the Muppets where they whisper into the one Muppet's ear, and by the time it gets down to the fifth Muppet, it's basically the same story, but there are some different little twists and turns. And I think that's what happened back then as well, from, you know, my sense that I got of it. And if you think about it, it would make sense. But I do think that it was important to get the story out. To me, it's amazing the time frame that it took from the time that they did their story and the time they took even pictures from the end of the run to the time it actually hit the papers in the lower 48. You know, you think today, like you said, everything is instant. You can post something and everybody across the globe sees it. But there was this time frame where it did take time to tell the rest of the world exactly what was going on up there in Nome.
Daniel, do you know how long it would take for you know, news to get out to us, at least by newspaper, from the time that, let's say, that the serum was delivered to the time the rest of the folks, maybe in New York, Philadelphia, Washington, when they found out about it, at least in terms of the lay people, not necessarily the into the know folks?
Well, there were telegraphs. There was a wire system, and there was an AP stringer who happened to be the mayor of Nome, in Nome at the time. I think news traveled fairly quickly, but accurate news did not. I mean, there were no reporters already in Nome,
right?
From the lower 48, they had to rely on people in Nome, each of whom did their best, but also had their own agenda, which is a whole story in itself. One thing that's important to sort of comprehend here is that there was this period of journalism then in the 20s that went away and is now back again. The kind of anything goes, unchecked journalism. In the 1920s, there was a circulation of newspapers. I'm not going to say a figure because I'll say it wrong. I don't know the exact figure, but many millions more newspapers were in circulation than are today, which is an astounding thing to think about. Most papers had a morning and an evening edition.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, I had to sort through at least 7 or 8 newspapers, if not more than that, all of whom covered this story. And it was just, you know, the Serum Run coincided with this period of a race to tell a great story to the most people you possibly can, as colorfully as you possibly can. And it was a perfect story for that because no one could challenge any facts. You could make things up, and you could certainly, as an editor, you could write whatever headline you wanted, even if it contradicted the body of the article, which it often did.
So nonfiction becomes fiction, fiction becomes nonfiction, and it kind of gets blurred in there.
Yeah, and the story of the photographs is a great story, which we only tell part of in the film. But there were photographs taken within Nome that were then sent back down the trail by dog team, and there was film footage, which we show in the film, taken at the time of the arrival of the serum by Nome residents, and there was this dramatic handoff in the middle of the ocean, north of Seattle, of a canister of film and a bag of negatives, you know, from a ship to a small tugboat, which then went back to another ship and brought it back to Seattle, where the Seattle papers published it, and then it went national, and that process was a 5-week or something process, which is really interesting. And in the interim, of course, everybody created their own photographs, either restaged them or took old photographs of a musher or of a dog and stuck them with the story. So that's also part of the fiction, nonfiction part of the newspapers at the time.
Wow.
Dorothy, we have about 7 minutes left, and I'm sure you want to have a wrap-up question or two. My really last question for you, Daniel, is anytime people are making films, a lot of times the viewing public doesn't understand the breadth of the time and effort it takes to make a film of any type. What was kind of the beginning and the end in terms of, and of course it's not done, it hasn't been released, so all of that's still to come. But what is the time frame from the time you started thinking about this story to at least where you're at right now?
Well, we're at more than a decade, I'll put it that way.
And, wow, holy cow.
You know, a fair amount of that is fundraising. We're still trying to raise the final funds to be able to release the film. In fact, if people go to the website that was mentioned, icebound film.com, they'll at least for the next month or so, they'll come across our crowdfunding website, because we still need to raise our finishing funds. It's doubly difficult these days for historical films because of the sources of funding for this kind of thing is for documentaries is more geared towards social action, advocacy films, and not just American history stories, which you know, if we did this in a more conventional way, and were commissioned, for example, by a cable network, it would have been completed in 6 months, and we would have just regurgitated the myth. We wouldn't have had any time to do the kind of work that we did. And so it's actually this somewhat unknown division of the federal government, a division of public programs at the NEH, that makes this kind of storytelling possible. by allowing for the kind of research and understanding the importance of it and telling the story right. But it's a question I appreciate because, yes, it's hard to comprehend what's required to do, not just in terms of research and writing, but you know, the kind of production work that needed to be done in Alaska.
Right.
You know,
10 years, what a feat. And of course, like you said, you still got a lot of work to do, not only with raising the funds, but then, of course, after it's released, all of that work that, you know, the press tours and you know, all of that comes with that. And I know you mentioned off air, Daniel, about a release date. You said possibly end of the year, beginning of next. Any plans on coming up here to a film festival or two? I know there's a big one in December here in Anchorage.
Well, I certainly have a commitment to have the film, you know, start its life in Alaska. I wouldn't have allow a release that didn't come after premieres, and especially I have a commitment that to bring the film to these communities in the interior and on the coast and in Nome that helped make the film. I want to make sure to do that. We've been trying to raise money to do that as well, and that's something I feel very strongly about. So Alaska is not going to see their story told without them having an opportunity. I guarantee you that. I don't want to do that. It's an interesting thing that this film has created, at least at the moment, more of an interest internationally than in the United States, even though it's truly an American story. But there are now broadcasts planned on the BBC and in German and French television in 2014, and we're just now pulling together what we hope will be our domestic release schedule. But at the moment, it's only firmed up abroad, which is an irony, which I can't tell you why that is, but that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, Daniel, in the mushing world, mushing is huge in Europe, in Germany in particular. For whatever reason, it's kind of like the phenomenon with American football. Everybody all over the world loves American football, so I guess it's kind of the same, at least in terms of mushing as well. We've really captured a worldwide audience, at least in terms of the sport. I don't know necessarily about the historical significance of the Seerman, but for one reason or another, everybody around the world, especially in Europe, loves mushing. Dorothy, just about out of time here, do you want to ask a final question to Daniel?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Daniel, what is your overall hope for Icebound?
My hope is that it reaches the right audience that we intended it to, which is, a broad national audience, with both a broadcast and some kind of play in what's called non-theatrical or art house theatrical. And I also think that there actually is a very important children's component to this, both the fact that it's a children's story that they'll be interested in seeing the real story of Balto, for example, but I think that there are messages in the film about media literacy, about public health, about Native history that could be told really well and taught really well, I should say, with the film as a as a component of that lesson. And so I have a hope for an educational life for the film too, eventually. So that's something I have in mind to also raise some funds and do in the next few years.
Wonderful. I mean, it is an excellent film. I know Robert and I both agree. I mean, it would be wonderful to get this out there so folks can definitely see it. In the meantime, they can get more information if they go to www.iceboundfilm.com. And you also have a Facebook page, correct? They can go there and visit that as well?
That's right. Yeah, we have an Icebound Facebook page. I think it's linked to from that page.
So. Okay, wonderful.
Yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on the Sci-Vibe, and I wish you much luck with the film, and I hope to see it out soon here in the U.S. Maybe something like the History
Dorothy.
Of the Travel Channel could pick it up.
Yeah.
I think it would be wonderful.
Thank you. It's been delightful to have these correspondences with you over these many months, and I'm glad to finally talk to you. So thanks
yes,
so much.
Yes, same here. Thank you. And again, if folks would like to see some of these great stills from the set, the newspaper clipping, there's a great shot of Balto and Togo that was given to us courtesy of Icebound Film and Daniel, please visit the fivesides.blogspot.com, put in Icebound in the search box, and it'll pull up the March article with a lot of these photos that are in there, and it also has the trailer preview. It's a great thing to look at.
Daniel, thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Yeah, thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you. You're welcome. Have a great day. Have a good day, Robert.
Thank you. And this, on behalf of our guest today, Daniel Anker, and our host for the Sci-Vibe, Dorothy Wills-Raftery, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.